kind of experience them.
House Committee on Revenue for Tuesday, June 16, 2009, will come to order. We'll open the work session on House Bill 2078. Colleagues, not to leave you in suspension, this the Dash 3 amendment is a very long amendment that encompasses some pieces of other bills, and the intent is to send it to Ways and Means this morning for further processing, and Chris will explain the amendment to us, the Dash 3.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In your packet, along with the Dash 3 amendment, I prepared a cheat sheet that's titled House Bill 2078-3. Has a little table on the front of the page. And most of the bill, the policies in here are a combination of the of 2914, the Dash 2, the reconnect with the selective disconnect, and portions of House Bill 2180B, which passed before the other day. And the pieces in here are the elimination of the gasoline hybrid credit and the biomass credit provisions. So as you can see in the sheet, most of the sections there from 1 through 46 are the federal reconnect. And they've largely just changed the date from December 31st to 2008. And there are some sections, for example, 21 and 22, which are kind of parallel amendments, where Section 21 just changes the date from December 31st, 2008 to May 1st, 2009, it maintains that the fixed date connection, not the rolling reconnect. But then, for example, in Section 22, it's identical to Section 21, except that it has the rolling reconnect language. And I'm looking here on page 39 on lines 3 and 4. So there are a number of sections that are in there twice, one maintaining the fixed date and the other maintaining the rolling reconnect. The bill would establish the rolling reconnect beginning January 1, 2011. But for now, it would be the fixed date connect. And then in sections 37 and 39 are the disconnect from the cancellation of debt, the bonus depreciation, and the Section 179 expensing. And these are the discussions that you had on 2914, the Dash 2. Other pieces in the bill, sections 40 and 41, are other connections relating to the definitions of severe disability and qualifying child for the Working Family Child Care Credit. And then in sections 42 and 44 are the unemployment provisions, identical to the Dash 2 from 2914. And then in the final sections of the bill, sections 47 and 48 are the elimination of the gasoline hybrid credit. Section 47 is for the RETC portion of that credit. And section 48 is for the BETC portion of the credit. And then sections 49 through 51 are the biomass credit provisions. And all of that language is identical to what was in 2180B. So that's somewhat briefly summary of the bill. You have, there is a minimal fiscal impact, and you also have a revenue impact statement for the bill. And the revenue impact shows, combining all of these policies together, a slight revenue gain in 2009-11 of $900,000, $4.3 million in 2011-13, and a minimal impact in 2013-15.
And I take it that LC has ruled that this is not a bill for raising revenue.
Correct, Mr. Chair. They've decided that, they've ruled that it's not a bill for raising revenue, and it's kind of a combination of the policies contained in the bill and the pattern, if you will, of the revenue impact, given that two of the three biennia, there's a pretty small impact. And the policies within the bill, there's a combination of things that increase revenue and cost money. It's just that in combined altogether, there's a slight positive impact in the biennia.
Okay.
And then,
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I guess one other piece I was going to include this. There's kind of an overlap with 2067, which has passed both chambers, and that is the bill that sunsets the credits. And so within that bill, it sunsets the entire Betsy credit on January 1, 2012, so that the elimination, for example, here, the elimination of the hybrid credit has no impact in 2013 to 2015 because the leading bill, 2067, which has already passed the Assembly, sunsets that entire credit on January 1, 2012. So sunsetting it here, you have an impact for 2 years, but then there is no impact in subsequent years. So that's part of the reason there's a minimal impact there. So the elimination of the hybrid credit raises about $4.5 to $5 million a year for 2 years, 2010 and 2011. Under 2067, it's already sunset in tax year 2012. So that's part of the reason there's kind of an odd pattern to the revenue impact.
Okay. Is this clear? What? Let me give you a little bit of a background. There was a meeting on Saturday in which a lot of these conversations took place, and we realized that the plan that we had put together involving the Betsy credit bill that we spent so much time on and House Bill 2180 was not going to work the way it was structured. The reconnect bill had a significant revenue impact that was going to be a problem. So we essentially pulled apart 2180, put a couple of the pieces in here, and I think the other pieces are going to end up in another bill, perhaps the Betsy bill. I think that's the plan in the Senate at this point. I understood it on Saturday. I'm not sure I can repeat what I understood on Saturday, but that's how this bill got this interesting mix. We deal with the need to reestablish the rolling reconnect and make the job of the tax preparer and the CPAs much, much simpler, especially on minor issues that we're not paying much attention to. We maintain the policy that was adopted in February of disconnecting from very expensive depreciation items. But we also include in here pieces of what we had in House Bill 2180, the gasoline hybrid credit elimination, which I think everyone agrees is now obsolete and is simply costing us money for no good reason, and the biomass clarification. Now, that biomass clarification, I assume, is what was in 2180.
The language is identical.
And including the requirement for certification. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's talk. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I understand this correctly, it is a date certain point specific connection as of May 1st, 2009, and a continuation of the rolling reconnect on January 1, 2011. So we're going to have about a year and a half of sort of tax oddity, am I correct, where we have sort of double books for everybody because there's no rolling reconnect. You have to capture all these separate things. This is sort of like full employment for CPAs. You're nodding. My specific question is...
It's less full employment than it is at this moment, but you're right.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It is.
Yeah.
Very complicated. My specific question is, and I will request Legislative Council's opinion as to why this is not a measure for raising revenue.
Okay.
I mean, it looks to me that it's revenue raising by this revenue impact statement, and I will be asking council to weigh in on this.
Great. I think that's reasonable, and we should ask them to come. I would refer you back to the famous 17-page letter in which council made it very clear that simply the simple fact that a bill increases revenues doesn't necessarily make it a bill for raising revenue, which is what the constitutional requirement is. But there are a number of other reasons why you might adopt a bill besides the fact that it raises some money. And, of course, I think there's ample reasons.
I love making work for a alleged counsel, Mr. Chair, yeah. But I believe that the purpose of this is avoidance of federal basically federal stimulus package pieces that would impact our revenue negatively. So technically, you could say this isn't revenue raising, but in truth, that's its whole purpose, is to raise revenue by avoiding federal stimulus provisions that were designed to help businesses in this state get going again, something we desperately need. And unfortunately, this is a very complex, convoluted, and probably disastrous sort of herk and jerk in order to avoid that, and then stick this back in there and then connect it up with the Betsy. I think your comments today were very telling. On first explanation, you got it. On second explanation, you're still struggling to understand it. And believe me, I just looked at this. I have had no chance to understand this, and I will be voting today against it, as you can well imagine.
Thank you. I would simply note that most of the bill is identical to the bill that we considered the other day, number
2914-2.
The difference is the addition and added pieces involving the items at the end, 47 through section 47 through 51, which we have discussed in great detail when we talked about House Bill 2180. So it's not as though we haven't discussed this. We have. I do understand the point you're making. My only response to it is that the issues that you raise around revenue raising are existing law, that we're not making a change in that.
I understand.
In that piece.
I understand.
Further discussion. This bill does need to go to Ways and Means for further consideration. Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, move the dash threes to House Bill 2078.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves the dash threes to House Bill 2078. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, the dash threes are adopted. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2078 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Bailey moves House Bill 2078 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion. We've already had some. You don't need to repeat it if you don't
want
to.
I'm not going to.
Okay.
I think I've made my point.
Others? Thank you. Carol, please call the roll.
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Representative Bent.
No.
Representative Berger.
No.
Representative Bruin.
No.
Representative Gelser.
Ah. Committee will stand at ease. 2078 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, and we had gotten to you.
And so you would like to know how I vote?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, isn't this on the...
This is on the bill.
I would like to vote aye, please.
Thank you. Please, continue.
Representative Call.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Springer.
No.
Barnhart.
Aye. Motion having received the required majority is adopted. House Bill 2078 goes to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2078 and open a... Let's see. What kind of am I doing next? Crap. Let's do Tribal Enterprise Zones, huh? Okay. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 726. Got a bunch of people.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, this bill, Senate Bill 726, expands eligibility for reservation enterprise zone. The original legislation on reservation enterprise zone enacted in 2001 and amended in 2005 contained restricting criteria that only allowed two of the nine Oregon tribes to qualify, that is Warm Springs and New Material. This bill eliminates these restricting requirements in terms of median income and unemployment rate. This bill also gives businesses in reservation enterprise zone an option to take advantage of exemptions and credits that are available in enterprise zones.
Thank you. We have people to hear from. Michael Mason, Justin Martin, and Dale. And I'm not going to be able to read the last name. I apologize. It looks like Dale. Or maybe Dallas.
Dave.
Close. Man.
You see my problem. Bring Dave up. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the House Revenue Committee. Pleasure to be here. For the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here representing the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation. And the reason I'm speaking first is I have some history with this bill. Back in 2001, the tribes approached then-Representative Westland for a bill we came to call the Reservation Tax Equity Act. And it did a couple of things, but one of them was it created the possibility of tribes working with OECDD to designate a reservation enterprise zone. But it only created that possibility for the two tribes with the largest reservations, the Warm Springs and the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation. And the point of this, of course, is the need for incentives on the reservation to bring non-Indian partners in. Obviously, the tax, the property tax exemption and deferral that come with an enterprise zone is something that is not needed by the tribe. It's already exempt from state and local taxes, or immune, I should say, from state and local taxes on the reservation. But it's needed to bring in the non-Indian partners and capital that are necessary to do this sort of non-gaming development. Last year, during the government-to-government economic development cluster meetings, it became very clear that the other seven tribes, the seven restored tribes of Oregon, despite efforts of the Legislative Assembly in 2005, were still left out of this option, still did not have this option of creating a reservation enterprise zone. So the economic development cluster is one of its priorities, and again, that includes representatives of OECDD and Department of Revenue and other state agencies, as well as, the, of course, the tribes, put forward this option of what became Senate Bill 726 as a priority to level the playing field for the other tribes. So I think be happy to answer questions as we close on this. The Warm Springs is here supporting the other tribes. This doesn't really do much for the tribes as such, but it will assuage my guilt from 2001 for leaving them out. So thank you.
Thank you.
Please. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. Thank you very much for this opportunity to be here in full support of Senate Bill 726. What I've distributed to the committee and put into the record is some testimony, so you can see that in front of you, but I want to highlight just a few things and thought it would be good for the committee to actually have some examples of what the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde actually intend to do with this legislation. First and foremost, we continue to look at opportunities and other ways to economically diversify our economy, not have all our eggs in one basket, so to speak, and we feel this legislation will get us down that road. In terms of what's in front of you, three potential land use opportunities. We think one is an industrial district for lands on Highway 18. Second, we have are looking at a commercial district for lands around our current casino facility. And then three, a cultural tourist district for lands that are adjacent to Fort Yamhill. This legislation would provide tribal decision makers, residents, and merchants with the tools, resources, and opportunities to realize social and economic stability and progress. So with that, you've got that in front of you. We'll be brief. We'd like to see this bill move. So thanks again for the opportunity, and please support Senate Bill 726.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Berger.
I have kind of a specific question for Justin, if you
wouldn't
mind.
Please, yes, go ahead.
Justin, I drive Highway 18 and 22 quite frequently, and you know and I know that the tribal casino has caused a traffic mess. And what you're contemplating here in terms of industrial, commercial, retail, any other attraction to that area is going to, shall we say, exacerbate the problem. So what consideration is given in this planning of this kind of activity to those of us who are just trying to get through and not stopping? There are a few of us. I know you're the biggest, you know, attraction in the state, but there are a few of us who just want to get by you.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, thank you very much for the question. As you know, and as I've known since working in this building in 1995, prior to the casino, that route has always been a difficult one, and we've worked very well with the federal government in looking at solutions, and I'm also very proud of what this body has done in terms of the government-to-government relationship, as well as working with the agencies to help alleviate some of those problems. And we, as a responsible business owner and as a responsible community partner, continue to look at opportunities and other options in looking at getting people to and from within that highway. And we look at other highways as well. We were part of the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. We've been working over the past 7-8 years with ODOT specifically on that, and as you've driven lately, you've seen some of the improvements that we're looking at making. So we will continue to make those efforts, Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, well into the future, and are always open in looking at and having those discussions with local, federal, and state governments in terms of finding solutions for that area.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just sort of put on the record that in developing these kinds of things, commercial, retail, industrial, that you are well aware of the impact that that's going to have on traffic and will be very proactive in seeking solutions before you build.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, there's a sentence, line 19 on the first page of the bill. It says, upon request, the department shall designate. And I didn't have time to go back and check to see if that shall is different than other such zones. In other words, does the Department Economic Development have the opportunity to take into account the issues Representative Berger just raised in making such a designation? In other words, the word shall would suggest it doesn't. And I'm just curious if you think the Department of Economic Development should have some more say in whether or not these zones are allowed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I think I'll defer to our lawyer here on the end in terms of answering that question. Mays and shells.
Chair Barnhart and Vice Chair Bentz, in response to that question, it was deliberate in the 2001 Act that the shell, because of it being on reservation. It's not a shell when it comes to the partnership zone that is also referenced. Other enterprise zones, yes, they have to work close, well, we would have to work also with OECDD, but the OECDD actually designates and goes through a process with local governments on other enterprise zones and would on the partnership zone that's contemplated in the bill. But as far as the actions on the reservation, there are limits on that magnitude of the zone, I should say the geographic area. There are certain limits that OECDD insists be in there, and that's why they will be reviewing it, to make sure that it follows the law, but there's not, they don't have the ability to stop it outright as they do with other zones.
Yes, but I do want to get quickly to our third witness. Yeah, please, go ahead.
All right, my name is Dave Tubby. I'm the Economic Development Director for the Sledge Tribal Business Corporation. I'm a Umatilla tribal member of Cayuse and Nez Perce descent, along with the obvious hereditary gifts from my Welsh father. But I spent most of my career with the Umatilla Tribe as Economic Development Director and later Executive Director, and then spent a stint down with Coquille in North Bend as their Executive Director. In 2007, I was Deputy Director and General Manager for Cayuse Technologies, the joint venture the Umatilla Tribes have with Accenture on the one and only Enterprise Zone in the state of Reservation Enterprise Zone in the state of Oregon. We've been working on this bill as it occurred to us that Umatilla and Warm Springs were the only ones to qualify. We thought this bill would be a good solution to generate kind of the value proposition for private sector investment on tribal lands. We have two components there in front of you, one on trust land, and the trust land complication is the same they had at Umatilla. By its very definition, trust land is not taxed. We cannot extend that non-taxed opportunity to private sector investors. They're still exposed to the same kind of tax liability of property tax, corporate income tax, and other kind of taxation on trust land regardless of that status. We're trying to come up with another tool in enterprise zone. Mechanism works very well to generate that tax credit opportunity. The other option, and it really deals with the land tenure situation for the restored tribes, who's pretty much a mishmash of trust and fee lands scattered all over western Oregon. But this is a partnership zone where tribes can go into agreements with local jurisdictions that would generate that tax credit and also help that tribe with joint marketing, location, and the kind of planning that Representative Berger alluded to, and done in a very open way. I think the opportunity of tax credits is a big thing, but I know full well at Umatilla, tax credits were only part of the picture. I think having enterprise zones designated in partnership with OECD lends itself to a certain amount of credibility among the private sector as they come onto reservations. As you know, we're still dealing with a lot of confusion and complication as the private sector looks at developing on reservation lands, and this might help at least provide some edge on that marketing opportunity. And with that, I'll close and hope you'll support this measure.
Thank you. And Representative Vince, did you have other questions you wanted to ask now? Yeah, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little bit slow, so perhaps you can help me clarify a couple of points. It's my understanding, so on page 1, line 24, there is the deletion of the word entirely after located. And then the line that begins on page 25 and continues on to line 1 of page 2. Land designated as reservation enterprise zone pursuant to paragraph subsection B, A or B of this subsection may be outside the boundaries of the tribe's reservation. And in line 16 on page 1, it's 15 and 16, it indicates that the land does not have to be contiguous. The way I'm reading that, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that it is not intended to be the case that you could designate a reservation enterprise zone that has one footprint of land inside tribal lands and another footprint of land somewhere else outside of tribal lands on any piece of land owned by the tribe. Rather, that it is if it is outside the land for the tribe, that it would have to be land that falls into subsection B, A, or B, in which it's held in trust for the tribe, or which there's an application to transfer the land into the trust. Is that Is my interpretation of that correct?
If I may, Chair Barnhart and Vice Chair Bailey, yes, that's correct. And the change is necessary because in the case of the Warm Springs and the Umatilla tribes, putting a enterprise zone wholly on reservation made sense because they have a large reservation land base.
Mm-hmm.
That it's very different with the restored tribes in Oregon that have a core reservation area and then other parcels adjacent and nearby that have been added and put into trust but are not formally designated reservation. But yes, this does keep a, it's still kept to a discrete area of the, you know, 12 square miles.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So then would it, is the only case in which a tribe may have a reservation enterprise zone that covers both tribal and non-tribal lands that aren't part of this trust arrangement or pending for this trust arrangement, one in which it is a this partnership enterprise zone in collaboration with an adjacent local government. Is that correct?
Chair Barnhart and Vice Chair Bailey, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes,
follow
please.
Up, Mr. Chair. And so the purpose of the bill, if I'm understanding it correctly, is to establish these partnership enterprise zones to expand the eligibility for other tribes in the state to create both reservation enterprise zones and partnership zones, and then third, to delete the income and unemployment requirements that were previously within the reservation enterprise zone. Is that correct?
Chair Barnhart and Vice Chair Bailey, that's correct. And again, that's because on the, I mean, that was not an issue on these large residential reservations, the Warm Springs and the Umatilla. But the way the tribes have kind of rebuilt as they've gone through restoration and reacquisition of land, they don't necessarily have large enough populations, most of the restored tribes, large enough populations on the reservation to meet some of these requirements. Normal requirements for enterprise zones.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Uh-huh. Is there land that is currently outside tribal boundaries that is the trust land in 2B, A and B, or pending to become trust land on which there is currently an interest in development that might not qualify under the unemployment and income definitions? Was that part of it as well?
Well, again, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bailey, in terms of the partnership zone, it's our understanding that, I mean, that has to be done in conjunction with the local government, and as we understand it, meet the requirements of the enterprise zone statute generally.
I'm sorry, clarification, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I guess I was referring to the, not to the partnership zone, but
okay,
to the reservation enterprise zone in its case in which it's non-contiguous, and part of the non-contiguous part is on the land identified in Section 2, Subsection B, capital A and capital B, land held in trust by the United States for the benefit of the tribe or land for which an application to transfer land into the trust has been filed. My understanding is that wouldn't require a partnership enterprise zone. Yeah, that could be done with these changes under the reservation enterprise zone statute. So are there lands that currently exist there that if the median income requirements and the unemployment requirements were still in place, that development, that designation of those adjacent and non-contiguous lands would prevent the designation of a reservation enterprise zone?
Well, yeah, but I think the key issue is that the restored tribes don't have defined reservations. I think that's the real challenge we have here, and maybe other representatives will appear before you. We'll talk about that. The Attorney General kind of only recognizes the reservation boundaries, but those only really apply to Umatilla and Warm Springs, where all the other restored tribes usually have restored old logged-off BLM tracks as kind of their core forestry tracks, and then tribes are gradually buying back pieces in usually a checkerboard kind of manner in or around where their community resides. So therein lies a challenge for us to consider our own definition of reservation is sort of where our community resides itself. Grand Ronde, community of Celeste, North Bend, Coos Bay for Coquille, among others. So obviously in that regard, there's trust lands that exist outside of where that community might reside that may as well might well qualify if they meet those other other standards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answers my question.
Thanks.
Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. First of all, a conflict. My daughter-in-law and my grandson are enrolled Celeste.
We'll note your conflict.
Thank you. But the question is about the partnership zones. And my understanding is those partnership zones are exactly the same as other enterprise zones. And I'm looking at Nick Fish to see if he nods his head. He's not nodding his head. At some point, I would like to have Mr. Fish come up and tell me that about these partnership zones.
Okay.
I know what his interpretation is, and
good.
And I, well, at least understand, and I'm sure he could explain it. But I can tell you what our intent was to have this partnership opportunity where we have an adjacent taxing district that generates tax credits to convey on to the private sector tenant that we establish on the partnership zone. This evening, I'm going to meet with the Port of Toledo commissioners to ask them for that kind of support for a piece of property we have down there, the Toledo Mill site. It's about 70 acres of industrial tract adjacent to the Port of Toledo jurisdiction, as well as part of the property is within the City of Toledo boundaries. So that was sort of the key as we kind of thought through the legislation itself in terms of an on-reservation trust property enterprise zone and this off-reservation, if you will, fee property partnership zone. That was always the one we had in mind for that property.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Doris Penwell. And did you want to hear from Mr. Fish, too?
I would like to, yes,
well,
thank you.
Maybe he can come up. Please, go ahead while he's tomorrow.
Thank you, Doris Penwell, representing Association of Oregon Counties. When the tribal representatives proposed this piece of legislation, they came to AOC and representatives of AOC to see if we would agree to participate with them in sponsoring of the legislation. We ran it through our usual processes, and we indeed agreed that in the co-sponsor sense, we definitely could support them. There are areas around the state where a county has worked with some of the tribes and have tried to sort of promote the economic interests of an area. And sometimes it's overlapping between where the tribe is and where the jurisdiction of the county or the city or the port. So we agreed to support them in this legislation. There have been some amendments to the bill that we hope have clarified the way this should operate. But we definitely support the purpose of this, which is to allow the 9 recognized tribes to have an enterprise zone if they so desire to improve their economies. And we definitely try to work with the other local governments to support these kinds of endeavors as long as it satisfies, as long as at the local level they have the opportunity to choose to do that themselves rather than being imposed upon them. So we definitely support them. And I would like Mr. Fish, as Representative Riley did, to respond to some of the questions that have been asked, because we understood that in the co-sponsor sense, we would still have to be subject to the rules of the enterprise zones as established by the Economic and Community Development Department. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. We've been very happy to work with you, Matilla, and hopefully someday Warm Springs with the existing law, and are very happy to comment or provide answers to your questions on the bill.
Great. Representative Riley.
Thank you. I just wanted to know how the partnership enterprise zone differs, if at all, from a regular enterprise zone that we always talk about.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, members of the committee, my interpretation of the bill, as in the context of the statutes to which it would join, is that the tribal or the
partnership
reservation partnership zone is not an enterprise zone. Mm-hmm. It is simply that, a reservation partnership zone. I understand the intent, and I was under the assumption, maybe even when it was still the wrong interpretation with the bill as introduced, that we're kind of talking about two new kinds of enterprise zones, or two new kinds of reservation enterprise zones, of which, you know, you would have one each, or the tribe could each of the nine tribes could have one each, or two, one of both kinds. And that the one would operate strictly on tribal lands, be they trust or reservation, as opposed to and, which is the operative word in the current law. Mm-hmm. In this law, and here it's or for a lot of things. And that then you'd have these partnership zones, which could be a sort of mixture of some tribal land plus some non-tribal, or what is frequently termed fee land. And that would be a kind of a co-sponsored partnership thing, and that would be great. But as I look at this, and I'm not sure the A and Gross really changed anything, it just made it clearer to me, is that, you know, you have throughout the statutes, and even in the next section here, Section 2, reference to the term reservation enterprise zone. And yet I don't find anything in the bill that would say explicitly, in the way that the law has to operate, okay, that a reservation partnership zone is itself a reservation enterprise zone for this purposes of this bill or the other existing statutes in these regards regarding the tribal trust credit or property tax abatement. So that's fine, and it's a good tool to work with, but I do not see anything where there are state provisions, tax or otherwise, that would incur or accrue to that type of designation.
Please. Could they overlap?
Yeah, if the two were themselves enterprise zones, then it wouldn't make sense. They shouldn't probably in practice. Of course, that would be rather redundant and confusing. But when's a partnership zone doing something else? Maybe of no great material emphasis at the moment. You could have considerable overlap. And you know, again, I don't wish to say there's anything, you know, wrong about either approach, but I am fearful that there will be people that will assume a partnership zone will operate just like an enterprise zone when I don't see that being legally possible.
And what does a partnership zone do?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I mean, all that the law would provide here is contained in lines 12 through 19 on page 2 of the Engross bill.
Right.
There's no other reference in statute to this type of entity, and so I think what you offer is a opportunity for partnership between presumably neighboring other governments, port cities, counties, and the tribe. And there could be, and this is where I know there were earlier discussions, this could be a sort of an entree or a platform for federal types of things, that, you know, there may be opportunities under the federal statutes to use this as the premise for sort of jointly attaining federal resources that the tribes and other communities could do in some amount of tandem.
Thank you.
I understand this now. I'm fine with it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Colleagues, are you ready to work this bill today, or do you want to hold it over till tomorrow? What's your pleasure? Work it. Do you want to work it?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vance, we're in public hearing.
I was just going to mention that Mr. Fish's remarks do raise the issue of whether or not this bill accomplishes what the authors thought it was going to accomplish.
I get a head nod or not? Okay. They think it does.
They think it does.
All right. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 726 and open a work session on Senate Bill 726A. Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 726A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bailey moves Senate Bill 726A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Bill goes to the floor. Who'd like to carry this bill? Representative Riley will carry. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 726 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 832. Okay.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 832. A quick background on the Senate bill. This comes to you from the Senate Revenue Committee, counterpart on the Senate side. And this bill has started at one time as Senate Bill 62, and it was worked on the Senate side, and it was then referred to the Ways and Means Committee. That's Senate Bill 62. However, some of the language in Senate Bill 62, I think, had to deal with rates on that the state treasurer charges agencies and so on, and that where the Ways and Means issues were. However, it seems like Senate Bill 62 did not make it out from the other side. So Senate Bill 832 took the version that is basically about the reorganization of some of the structures from Senate Bill 62 and put it in 832. So Senate Bill 832A comes to you as the new Senate bill that has to do with the collateral, short-term collateral pool for the state treasurer. Now, what it does in short, and we would have probably a little more definition from the state treasurers.
All right, shall we hear from him then? Why don't we do that? Mr. Bond? Colleagues, given the short hour, we may extend this hearing till tomorrow. Are you available tomorrow if we
need to do that? I am, sir. I can be quick describing the bill, I think.
Thank you.
For the record, Darren Bond, Deputy State Treasurer. As Mazin indicated, this started out as Senate Bill 62, which was primarily a housekeeping bill. We then realized through our efforts to manage the state's collateralization function covering the security of public funds that there was a number of issues that came to light as we worked through the financial dislocations we've had over the last several months and determined that a number of changes need to be made to those collateralization statutes. So that significantly altered the look of Senate Bill 62. As Mazin indicated, 62 got caught in Ways and Means, so we excised those parts that were necessitating that, and we have then a pared-down version of the bill that you see here. Last session, the legislature, at the request of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Association of Oregon Counties, substantially revised the collateralization statutes. They made it more streamlined, a little more elegant in administrative function, centered a lot of the activities of the treasurer's office. Everything was well and good until we went through the last, the last several months, and we realized that there's a number of issues. The basis of the change was to create a shared liability pool structure where if an institution fails and they don't have enough collateral pledged to cover the public funds on deposit, that the other institutions participate in that in covering that loss. One thing that came to light is that the way the structure is currently put in place, weak institutions have a higher risk than strong institutions, and creating the risk of potentially a cascading failure event. So we looked to address that. We have worked countless hours with the Oregon Bankers Association, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and the Department of Justice to craft the changes that you find in Sections 1 through 16 of the bill. We've done four things. We've changed the definitions so that all institutions are treated the same in terms of their risk of liability to another institution's failure. We have tightened up the timelines in the chapter so that actions are taken more promptly to address any risk to public funds. Thirdly, and quite importantly, we have made it so that non-state chartered institutions are required to provide similar information to DCBS as our state chartered institutions are. The director is our primary advisor relative to the financial stability of the institutions, and for them to not have that same level of information for all institutions, we believe was an impairment to the process, and so this rectifies that. And finally, there's more flexibility provided to the treasurer and the director in terms of establishing plans to address an institution that's experiencing some financial weakness, get them to a position where they are adequately collateralizing public funds, but not have to take such a precipitous act that it might in and of itself trigger failure. That is pretty much the changes to ORS 295 that you'll find in Sections 1 through 16. The remaining sections of the bill are primarily housekeeping in nature. We're also asking for amendment, and there was a numbering issue apparently with the amendment, so it didn't get here today. That deals with the highway fund and lottery fund and making sure that they are able to be invested appropriately. When the discrete investing language was put in place last session, apparently through an oversight, the lottery and highway were left out of that, and that amendment will fix that.
Right. I should note that that is identical to the dash 4 you have in front of you. We'll get the numbers fixed on the caption so that you actually can move the amendment, but the language will be the same.
And that is the substance of the bill. I can talk about any of the other sections specifically, but in the interest of time, I am happy to be done.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious. I noticed a couple of senators voted against the bill on the Senate side. Do you have any idea what the cause for concern might have been?
Mr. Vice Chair, I don't. We made an inquiry and haven't had a response. There was no opposition in committee either when 62 went through or when 832 went through.
Yes, Representative Bentz.
I noticed there is a clarification of the authority of the treasurer to act as treasurer. Did that cause any sort of a shift of authority from anybody, or is that just a clarification of his power?
Relative to the e-commerce, the banking functions?
Mr. Chair, I was looking at Section 22.
Section 22. Yeah. No, it doesn't. It's a clarification. The treasurer has provided banking services to state agencies for decades, and we continue to do so. State treasurer is designated the cash management officer for the state. And recently, in the last year or so, there has, for whatever reason, been some question as to exactly what cash management meant, even though it's an industry standard term. We, at the suggestion of DOJ, offered a clarification that banking is explicitly covered in that, even though, again, in any reasonable definition of cash management, it already is so. Strictly clarification.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The final question, and this goes to a conversation I had with Mike from your office, and it was just an issue of who it is we look to assure us, other than your office, that this collateralization arrangement is, I'm going to say, I hate to say normal, but whatever would be used by other states in similar circumstances. Is this a peer-reviewed device? Is this a, how do we know that by the way, I have great faith in your department. I think you have an excellent department. So don't view this as a criticism. I just am curious, what standard do you use when you're trying to figure out how to appropriately collateralize the billions of dollars that are held in this system?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Bence, the system is built on industry standard terminology, and the FDIC measures capitalization of institutions and publishes those numbers. And capital levels, being well capitalized, adequately capitalized, and undercapitalized, are the industry standard terms, are based on a matrix-driven model that they have. So it's an FDIC-based measurement. Information comes off of banks' call reports, which are their quarterly financial reports that they submit to the regulators. So that determining the level of capitalization is a standard, matrix-driven methodology, a process that we have in place. And actually, we have a computer model that just does it. That's in place. There is an element of management of the institutions that also comes into play. That's where we rely on the director, the bank regulators at DCBS. They know the institutions personally. They, through their examinations, they know what's happening in the institutions, and they're able to identify stresses before we might and before the capital change happens. As we've seen through this past experience, this really has been a problem that's not been first identified by capital weakness. It's been identified by liquidity constraints. There was a tremendous liquidity crush, and that resulted in banks folding that when you looked at them on paper, they were still a well-capitalized institution. So we experienced that right here in Oregon because of the ability for the Department of Consumer Business Services to look into those institutions. They're able to help us identify liquidity constraints that we might not otherwise be able to. To speak to your model, there's 50 states, there's 50 different models. Ours is, we actually communicated quite extensively. The version that we have of 295 was probably originally drafted in about, 98, somewhere around then, and it took a while before it got into the session. It was done with a lot of input from the bankers who have experienced this around the country. One of the the best model at the time that they pointed to was the Washington model. We took the Washington model honestly, and we made it better. And as you can see, Washington's having problems with their model, and so far we're not having them with ours. But this will make ours substantially better.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Ann Hannes?
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties. The aim of this bill is to improve the security and lower the risk of public funds deposited in banks. I think Darren's done a good job of walking you through the bill and what it means. Because of today's economic times, it's especially important to have this in place to ensure the security and reduce the risks associated with public deposits. I also want to note that in addition to AOC supporting this bill, Michael Novak from League of Oregon Cities also asked me to state that League of Oregon Cities is a supporter of the bill as well. Thank you.
Thank you. This is the...
Oh, and I have my testimony.
Oh, you do. Okay. This is a situation in which we're talking about protecting assets that belong to public entities, including counties, cities, school districts,
correct,
special districts, and others.
It's extremely important right now. I mean, about a year ago, this would have been all theoretical with the banks closing down. It's not theoretical. We need this urgently.
Well, and of course, we did do some changes in these rules in the recent past.
Mm-hmm.
This is a refinement that we hope will make it better. Is that a reasonable characterization?
Very much so.
Thank you. Any questions for Ann? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. We'll look forward to your written testimony. Colleagues, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 832. Keep your eyes open for postings. I don't know whether there'll be another meeting today or not, but there may be. There certainly will be one tomorrow. Be prepared to work this bill. There may be some other things to do as well. Is there anything else? See you on the floor. Committee is adjourned.